We originally hoped, and this was back in March, that we hoped for a fourth quarter recovery in somewhat of a V shape. And, you know, as the weeks and months progressed, you know, we know that that's just not happening. And right now there's less than a 30% probability of that happening. Right now there's a 60% probability that it's going to be a mid 2021 recovery and more of a U shape.
Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. In this podcast, Vince Menzione, a proven industry sales and partner executive, brings together technology leaders in this forum to discuss transformational trends and to deconstruct successful strategies to thrive and survive in the rapid age of cloud transformation. And now your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. For this 63rd episode of the podcast, I sit down for an interview with Jay McBain, the principal analyst, channels, partnerships, and ecosystems at Forrester. Jay is a thought leader in the channel, and in this episode, we discuss the work he does supporting the channel, his predictions for the channel both before COVID, and how he sees the impact on organizations now, and how he sees the channel evolving in what he calls the trifurcated channel model, as the landscape of partner vendors is changing, and the need and the role of the channel is evolving. It was good to have Jay on the podcast, as I always enjoy our conversations. He is a wealth of knowledge and a walking encyclopedia of the channel, and because of the work he does across a broad sampling of the technology giants, his perspective on the transformation is insightful. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as I enjoyed learning from Jay. I'm also thrilled for the lineup of amazing guests and topics we'll be discussing in the weeks and months ahead, so please stay tuned to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. As with each of my episodes, I appreciate your support. Please tell your friends about the podcast and where they can find us. And I'd love your feedback. Please like the podcast and provide comments or reach out to me at Vince Menzione on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also like and follow at facebook.com/Ultimate Guide to Partnering. Or drop me a line at vincem@cloudwavepartners.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have you as a guest on Ultimate Guide to Partnering. You and I had the opportunity to work over the years, first when I was at Microsoft and you were leading ChannelEyes, and then most recently in your role as Principal Analyst, Channels, Partnerships, and Ecosystems at Forrester. I've been a big fan of your work, and I followed your blog posts and appearances on other podcasts, and I'm excited to have you here today. So welcome.
Yeah, this is great. Really excited.
Yeah, I'm excited as well. I'm going to dive right in. You know, today is July 14th, 2020, and we have a lot to talk about. There's a lot happening. I know you're down in Florida right now, which is sort of the epicenter of what's been happening with COVID. But I don't just want to talk about COVID. I want to talk about what's been happening specifically around our channel. And as the principal analyst, channels, partnerships, and ecosystems at Forrester, you're in many respects the eyes and ears of the channel for so many. And right now, I know at this time, you've been talking quite a bit about what's been happening in the channel. Can you begin by telling our listeners just a little bit about the scope of your role and whom you serve?
Yeah. So the easiest way to tell a non-channel person what I do is that 75% of world trade, you know, as measured in GDP, goes through channels. You bought your last car from a dealer. You bought your last TV from a retailer. You bought your last jar of peanut butter from a grocer. You have to think in your personal life, unless you bought like a Dell computer in the past direct, or unless you buy Geico insurance direct. I mean, there might be a couple of examples, but pretty much your entire life, both in personal and business world, is wrapped around intermediaries. So that's the channel world. And I get to span all 27 industries. So I get to move from a pharmaceutical conversation to a HVAC and plumbing conversation to a financial insurance conversation, and then over to technology. So, you know, in terms of the way channels run, the way the channel is organized, the technology underneath it, the processes, the programs, the people, it's just a fascinating topic. And I love to wake up every day and engage.
Well, I know, and you've been in the thick of everything that's been going on. And as I said, we were recording this on July 14, 2020, and we're living in a time like no other. And I've written about this time of uncertainty and what it's doing to our technology sector. And I know you've been writing on COVID and the impact it's having on the channel in your blog posts. I think you started in March with that. In fact, I know you've written a couple of posts. and you've spoken about this on podcasts and at events. And I'm hoping you could share some of what you're seeing with our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I started writing about it is most of the analyst firms and people that analyze this industry, they talk through products, which is great. So, there are 26 categories of technology products, hardware, software, and services. And then there's about 200 subcategories. So if you want to know, how PCs are going to fare or how, SaaS financial software is going to fare. I mean, there are all kinds of analysis, but that doesn't really lay on the channel element to it. Because so as I started looking at those 200, categories, I know that PCs are 80% channel led. So that has a disproportional impact on the channel, whatever that growth number or the decline number is going to be, as compared to maybe some of the cloud categories that only have a 20% channel impact. And so as I started looking across the entire, set of analysis and research, I looked by buyer, I looked by sub-industry, there's 297 sub-industries. I looked by geography, not only by the 196 countries, but the states and provinces and even cities within them. I looked at the sector, segment, and size of customers. We know that customers that are, on the small level of SMB up through mid-market and enterprise are all weathering the storm differently. And then again, I put the layers of the tech stack on top of that. So there's 35 million permutations when you look at it that way. And rather than just saying that, yeah, the channel's going to do this or going to do that, I wanted to get it very granular for not only MSPs and VARs, but for the vendors, for the distributors to say that in your market, in your target addressable market size, here is what's happening. And that's really where I took my focus.
So how, on those permutations, I've been saying all along there's going to be winners and losers. How are you categorizing them? Are you breaking out which groups are going to be winners and which groups are going to be losers through this transformation?
Yeah, I mean, the first step is always, at a high level, making an industry call. And we originally hoped, and this was back in March, that we hoped for a fourth quarter recovery in somewhat of a V shape. And, as the weeks and months progressed, we know that that's just not happening. And right now there's less than a 30% probability of that happening. Right now there's a 60% probability that it's going to be a mid-2021 recovery and more of a U shape. And that U is going to be very specific to, again, those 35 million permutations. So I'm in Florida and, we just set a record on Saturday and broke New York's record. So the Florida man, reigns supreme here. And on the same day that we broke all kinds of records, we decided to open up Disney World.
Yeah, of course. Why not?
If you're selling to a business in Florida right now, which happens to be a small business that is in retail or hospitality or a restaurant, is going to be a very different scenario than selling to a technology company in Des Moines, Iowa. So given these different realities, we know that the industry itself, given, another year of pretty long, prolonged pain, the average MSP is going to drop by 17% in revenue in that time period. And we know that there's going to be winners. The managed services business model itself is somewhat insulated from that. So in the percentage of recurring contracts that a managed service provider has, we measure an MSP as 30% or more of their P&L is under managed services contract. That is only dropping by 1.9%. So that's a little bit of a bright spot, inside a bunch of double-digit negative numbers. We also survey 690,000 customers at Forrester every year. So we get to hear short-term, like the second half of July, August, September, where they're going to be spending money. Automation, cloud acceleration, security, customer experience, employee experience, marketplaces, e-com. We get to hear what the bright spots are going to be. And in today's world, a bright spot is either a flat or slightly growing business. Looks great when everything else is dropping by double digits.
Right. And it seems to me that, there's certain sectors. I think about education, this transformation that's going on in education right now. I think there's apps that haven't been created yet or maybe being created now to serve some of the needs that we hadn't foreseen with all these students working from home, right? And security that's got to be layered on top of that and other services and the like. What else are you seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got four kids. Two of them are in college. One of them is actually in law school. But the other two are in preschool. So there's a nice little 16-year gap between them. But I'm homeschooling, you know, like a kindergarten and, you know, a preschooler while listening to my law school student in Baylor and my, you know, university student up in Canada. You know, I'm getting both sides of that education feedback, both inside my family and obviously outside from Forrester. But we understand that education, like government and like healthcare, has been a bright spot. You know, this is actually one of those industries that had to significantly tool up to be able to serve their customers during this pandemic. And obviously, it's also accelerating given the pandemonium and everything else that 2020 has thrown at us. For those partners, those MSPs that are tied into municipal, statewide, or federal business, they're tied into education, either K-12 or higher ed. They're obviously tied into all levels of healthcare. Their business is growing. There's obviously a demand there. Whereas, you know, that business that's been focused on hospitality, retail, you know, restaurants and things like that have found a 90% drop in revenue.
It's been amazing. Hey, Jay, I want to go back a few months. Back in January, you and I had a conversation just after you published your predictions for 2020. And we had a discussion about some of the trends you were seeing, some of the amazing revelations. And I hope you wouldn't mind if we peel back now on that piece, especially now, given what we know, you know, 6-7 months later. It's amazing. It seems like it was just yesterday we had that conversation. But of the trends you outlined in January, which of these are still on track? And maybe you could talk a little bit more about them specifically. And what are you seeing now that you didn't expect to see then?
Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting is when I looked at the year and like 100% of other people, no one predicted COVID. The fact of the matter is, though, many of those predictions, there's about 10 of them, are accelerating during COVID. And, you know, different things have happened, obviously, as a response to COVID. But, you know, a couple of the predictions around ecosystems and something I call a trifurcating channel model, which sounds complicated, but it's really this future of transacting partners versus non-transacting. I started, you know, later last year, seeing some real data to show that the channel makeup was changing pretty significantly. We know that every company in every industry is becoming a tech company. Every professional services firm in every industry is becoming a tech professional services firm. 81% of accountants, 78% of digital agencies, everyone is flooding in to tech services. So I started to predict this idea that, you know, they're not your traditional reseller. They're not a managed service provider. They're providing a different layer of value to the customer. And with everybody flooding in, there's going to be, you know, and there is millions of partners out there now for the average vendor. So late last year, I saw Microsoft bringing on 7,500 new partners a month. And, you know, I get to visit Redmond back when we were allowed to travel, you know, at least go up there once a month. And I could report back to the executives of Microsoft that 80% of these new partners are non-transacting. They show up somewhere else in that customer journey and add value in a different way. I went over to AWS, who has doubled the size of their channel every year for 3 years. And they would have done it again if it wasn't for COVID. And I looked there and, you know, 90% of those partners are not what you would call transacting partners, like resellers, people who take money from customers. And then I went over to Salesforce, which I speak at Dreamforce every year, and they had just shut down their resale program. I'm like, in a future where the world revolves around ecosystems, how could you shut down an ecosystem? And they are very specific that they want all the money to come through the AppExchange. You know, they think, they look at the Forrester research to say that 73% of buyers would love to work, you know, buy in an e-commerce marketplace type of way. They want 100% of dollars to go that way. But they also said at the same time, and they work with Forrester to say, for us to influence all these buyers across the sales cloud, the marketing cloud, the customer success cloud, the communities cloud, and then their acquisitions of Tableau and MuleSoft and Steelbrick, you look at the entire corporation, which is valued at about $180 billion today on the stock market with $20 billion in revenue. They said for us to double the size of our company in 4 years, to go from $20 billion to $40 billion, we're going to require 250,000 new partners. And you think of that, and 100% of them are going to be non-transacting partners. So I spent time there and trying to dig my head into this and go, why as a partner would you ever, you know, have a partnership with Salesforce when there was no opportunity to make front or back end margin. There's no gold, silver, bronze program. There's no, you know, onboarding trail, like all that kind of stuff. It seemed like it was all anchored around that program, and now they didn't have one. So good luck on finding 200. Well, they're ahead of the curve right now on recruiting all those partners because they completely changed the economics of partnering. And the way they did that is they did research, again, using Forrester, that for every dollar of Salesforce that's sold to a client, the $20 billion today that's sold, there's $4.65 of downstream opportunity. And we've known this for years. Like Microsoft's products have somewhere between $5 and $9 of downstream opportunity. But we never talked about it because that's TCO and we kind of wanted to hide that from the customer. Well, there's Mark Benioff kicking off Dreamforce in front of 180,000 people in the audience and then 10 million people dialing in saying and bragging about the number. Because it's not just $4.65. 5 years from now, it's going to be $5.80. So if you're a customer and you're looking to buy, you know, $100,000 of CRM licenses, I hope you have $500,000 in the bank because that's what it's going to cost to get it to work. But then it's this ecosystem play where it's you look at that $4.65. They break it down into a pie chart, you know, 64% professional services. Inside of that, it's installation, implementation, integration, security, compliance, business continuity. They list off the 17 tech services. They list off the demand and supply by city around the world. They list off the margins, 75% margins that people are making, satisfying that demand. And they basically say, why would you spend a nanosecond thinking about 20% software margins when you could be making 75% margins, highly sticky, highly repeating, and build a business around this? You can't hire people fast enough and train them fast enough to take advantage of the opportunity in your home city. That's their value proposition. And it has nothing to do with a pyramid scheme of, you know, gold, silver, bronze benefits.
So what would be your advice to an organization, an ISV typically, that's looking to build or improve their channel ecosystem today? What would you tell them?
Well, I would say to them, and you're starting to see this mass movement. You talked about these predictions. I predicted a trifurcated channel. And so I've been laughing, you know, kind of over the last few weeks as almost every company has replaced their gold, silver, bronze program with a trifurcated program. 3 hours, 52 minutes, and 54 seconds ago, Google announced their trifurcated new program, which is a build, sell, and service program instead of, you know, sell, sell, sell program. 2 weeks ago, IBM announced theirs, AWS announced theirs, Microsoft announced theirs. Tomorrow, you may hear some rumblings around HP on their trifurcated program. Every big vendor is going through a big change from where they've been for 39 years, offering up these tiered programs anchored on resell. And they're learning that 80% of their future channel will be non-transacting. They will be other ISVs, IHVs, system integrators. It could be accountants and digital agencies. It's whoever influences their buyer. And that's how they're building programs. And it's really not a channel anymore. It's an ecosystem. It's a place where with those 35 million permutations I talked about, it doesn't matter how hyper-focused you are as a partner, you're going to walk into one of these ecosystems and feel at home.
And how do you attract and retain some of these? How do you get these influencers on board?
It's all about the multiplier. If you're an influencer, for example, so I'll walk through what trifurcated means. The first part of the journey, and we know that, you know, customers, at least 68% of them move in a digital way. You know, it's like buying a car. You go online and you do all the back and forth and you read all the magazines and you watch YouTube videos and you talk to people on your peers, your neighbors, your social networks. I mean, you do all this work. By the time you hit the dealership, you're pretty smart. You've already configured the car. You know more about that car than the salesperson ever will. You've actually looked up the invoice price. You know within $100 what you're going to spend. And then they put you through this 8-hour mess that's been there for decades where they try to get you this, you know, deal in air quotes. And you think to yourself for 8 hours, like, I would have paid more for them just to deliver the car to my driveway and hand me the keys.
I just went through it in January. And
there you go.
Painful.
So what we're learning is that every customer, when you're buying software, when you're buying hardware, when you're buying service from a managed service provider, they all have this 8-hour mess. And customers are fed up. Like, I'm smarter than you in terms of my very specific needs. And I need you to market and sell to me differently. So what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to avoid the marketing and sales funnel. And I'm going to do all the work by myself and with a group of, on average, five different influencers, partners, early in the journey. And the majority now of customers of technology are getting to vendor selection before ever talking to a salesperson. So guess what? You may have lost a deal without ever knowing there was a deal because it never hit your funnel. And this is the scariest thing to big companies, medium-sized companies, and even the smallest of ISVs that I talk to, is when Salesforce did the study and looked at all the different things they offer and looked at those virtual five people in every room of every opportunity looking forward, that's where they multiplied out to that 250,000 number. It's a big number. You have to build an ecosystem to influence the influencers of your customers and your prospects earlier in the journey than you ever have in the past.
You know, I think about the, I'll call them the hyperscalers, the big influencers. You mentioned Salesforce, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft being the big four to me in many respects. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out that's big, but I mean, they're all fighting for that mind share with some of the same partners in the same ecosystem. Like, what's the best, what are some best practices you're seeing? Like, yeah, I know you talked about technology and what others are using, but I hope you can share some of that.
Oh, of course. I mean, the fact today is that the average customer, so if we'll use cloud as a technology category, the average customer actually buys seven things. You know, Salesforce actually releases data that says for everybody who buys the CRM license or the marketing cloud license, they actually buy six other things. And that's what they use the AppExchange for, to procure it, to provision it, to manage and monitor and report on it and everything else. That's what the popularity of marketplaces are now in software, is that, you know, getting Larry in the white van to go chase down those seven companies and become a partner and get it all in a single bill for you could take months. And it just doesn't, and you don't want to rely on Larry, you know, to be able to do that, because that's not what Larry's good at. Larry's the person that can come in, and I put Larry in air quotes. Larry's the guy that comes in and, you know, installs and implements and integrates and can do all that really valuable work. But the actual transactional part is a waste of Larry's time, a waste of your time. And given that this seven layer cake, you know, given that it's not just the Salesforce license, it's the six other things that pave the last mile to your very specific problem. So when I talk about those 35 million permutations by industry, by buyer, by geography, et cetera, that's what's the most important thing to Salesforce in this equation, is that there are people building lightning bolts and building lightning flows and things on top of Salesforce as a platform to pave that last mile for that mid-sized healthcare clinic in upstate New York who wants to drive new patients in the door in a HIPAA and high-tech compliant way. So it's the partnerships and it's the ecosystems that will pave those last miles. And today there's 175,000 software companies. And I've predicted, by the way, 10 years ago, there was only 10,000. I predict 10 years from now, there's going to be 1 million software companies building product, building solutions for 35 million permutations. There's already 800,000 emerging tech companies, AI, automation, blockchain, Internet of Things, all the way down the list. There's a massive set of layers here. And so when you look at a customer, and this is forcing, this is probably one of the biggest changes of those hyperscalers. I walk into Microsoft, where I know you spent a lot of time, and you imagine their faces to say where, you know, you may not win the platform layer. Like Azure is actually growing faster than AWS and Google right now, but they're all growing in the 50s, 59, 54, and 51. But there's a high likelihood that there's a customer that's going to start their journey in AWS, not Microsoft, at the infrastructure layer. But now Microsoft has 16 other departments. They want to win everything from obviously 365 to Teams to security. They want to win Dynamics. There's a lot of conversations on top of AWS. So of the seven layer cake, Microsoft's going to want to compete on those six other layers. So they're going to be partnered with AWS and integrated with AWS. And Microsoft may actually offer the best solution for that particular customer, given an AWS scenario. The same thing with all four that you mentioned, that it's not just their marketplace. It's not just their stack. You can go ahead and lose the platform layer and go and win, you know, three or four of the remaining six layers of the conversation.
It's why you're seeing, you know, Salesforce acquired MuleSoft. You're seeing Microsoft really promoting Power Apps. And it's all about the connection, heterogeneous ecosystems, connections of all these different SaaS solutions, 175,000 of them today, right? So yep. They've all got to interoperate with one another.
And the world is now embedded. So, you know, I spent 17 years working at IBM. And, you know, IBM is a big, powerful company, but their sales team, which is a revered sales team, have been selling SKUs for 100 years. you know, back to weigh scales, you know, 100 years ago. The fact of the matter, though, is the future isn't about SKUs. You don't sell Watson as a SKU. So the only way to sell Watson is as an embedded or as a white labeled or some other business model. It's an ecosystem, intra-firm value creation. It's intra-firm joint innovation, co-selling, co-innovation. It's a different world. And if you're a salesperson that's trying to go and, you know, sell a customer on a particular SKU, you're going to miss the fact that Watson should be running on top of Salesforce, on top of Microsoft, on top of AWS, on top of Google. And that, you know, led to the Red Hat acquisition last year, is this idea that we may have lost maybe that infrastructure layer. However, the stack layer, the open stack layer above that, is where we're going to stake the future of our company on, is that there's a lot of things going on. And that seven-layer cake is open for conversation. And the millions of partners that are engaged, especially those five specifically at that customer virtual table, they need to know, and hopefully one of them, two of them, maybe even three of them, are knowledgeable about IBM, are knowledgeable about Watson, and even would endorse us at the right time as part of that customer conversation. So it doesn't matter where that customer starts their journey, there's pieces of IBM that are going to end up in that vendor selection. It's a different way to go to market. It's a different way to think about your ecosystem. And again, there's a, you know, 80 to 90% chance that that person early in that journey is not in your current 120,000 partners that you have in partner world. It's a different set of affiliates, affinity, advocates, ambassadors, digital influencers, super connectors. I mean, there's dozens of new kinds of business models that exist in that new world of influence and how they get paid.
It's an amazing time. What advice, I mean, we talked about advice for the organizations that you work with today, but what would you say to leaders right now in terms of, you know, we can't predict the future. We're talking about the U-shape. What advice are you giving to leaders right now in their, in these organizations?
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if I talk to a distributor, a vendor, a partner, an MSP of any type. I mean, the first piece of advice right now is obviously around your own survival. Do you have the plan and the financials and everything in place to weather the storm, you know, with that 60% probability of the next 12 months? You know, first and foremost is the health of you, your employees, your business, and your brand. The second piece of it is around your customers. Like I mentioned, every single one of your customers individually have a different journey, have a different set of behaviors, and right now with COVID have a different psychology. So you can't go send out a mass email right now. You can't put up a billboard or put out a radio ad. You got to be thinking about printing off a list of all of your customers, all of your prospects in your funnel, and getting very, very obsessed over where they are and what conversations and degree of empathy that you're going to have with them. So again, if you're talking to a Florida business that their business is down by 90% because they serve retail and hospitality, it's a different conversation than talking to a, you know, a tech business in the heartland that's growing. So, you know, looking at your customer base, getting, you know, those different vectors that I talked about, you know, is the buyer, where are they, you know, on the spectrum? Where are they from an industry or sub-industry? Where are they from a geographic? Where are they from a sector size and segment perspective? And where are they from a technology perspective in terms of maturity? That's going to guide your next best action. You have to have personalized conversations, basically, and they have to be consistent. So, I mean, we have industry examples that just happened in the last few days where, you know, you have a great conversation with a customer, then they come to your website and you're, you know, offering some discretionary purchase for that doesn't matter in an old way. You know, if you don't buy midnight, you know, buy it by midnight and you get a 10% discount. Or they're phoning your help desk and they're overworked and they're getting reamed out. Or they go to your social pages and there you are ranting about masks and personal freedom. So you got to be consistent and you've got to be very, you know, empathetic and strike the right tone. But you have to be more personalized now about your clients and more obsessed about your clients now than you've ever been in the past.
I'm in violent agreement there. I know some of the work that I've done, you know, spending a lot of time in front of the channel, in front of customers, taking a leadership position, elevating our voices. I think that's those are important themes right now and guidance for these organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And your customer is going to help you, you know, pave the next few months. They're going to help you pave the next 12 months. You know, are they looking in survival mode and to cut costs and to, you know, get your help in terms of driving and kind of shoring up and building those protections? Or are they on the other side of the spectrum that says, I'm going to take this as an opportunity, like other businesses did in 2008 and 2001, and I'm going to actually leapfrog my competitors, and I'm going to double down when everyone is, you know, shoring things up. So if you understand where your customer is, you're going to understand where, you know, you can add value. And again, focusing on those automation and cloud acceleration and kind of those broader topics of where you can grab bright spots and, you know, thrive yourself, you know, through these times. And that, again, is all vendors, distributors, and partner level.
I'm going to shift gears a second here. I wanted to, you know, as you know, I focus in and explore what makes great partnerships great. A lot of the genesis for this podcast was that. And as someone who spent the bulk of their career in this space, what do you believe makes, or what characteristics do you believe makes a great partner?
The biggest difference, and, you know, if I go back 39 years to the way I look at partnerships, to August the 12th, 1981, with the introduction of the first IBM PC, you know, IBM set up partnerships the way they, you know, a tire company or a car company would set up dealerships. You know, you get your geo-fenced region of your city, and, you know, they set up a system of conflict and rules of engagement and everything else. Well, a few years later, Compaq blew that out of the water when they signed up everybody who could fog a mirror. And then a few years later, Microsoft even blew it up further when they signed up everybody who couldn't fog a mirror. And you blew out this VAR system of 600,000 VARs around the world. Microsoft still has 355,000 of them signed up. They're aging, but, you know, that channel still exists from 39 years ago. So you look at that partnerships, and it's been very linear focused. The vendor sits behind the partner. The distributor sits behind the vendor. The routes to market, the go-to-market, it was all neatly fit on a PowerPoint slide. Well, when you blow that up, and given the trifurcated model and given a lot of the stuff we've already talked about, you're in an ecosystem model now. The easiest way to think about an ecosystem is to look up into the sky. You've got stars and moons and solar systems and comets and all kinds of things happening. Well, guess what? You might be a sun. You might be a larger, you know, organization with, you know, a lot of revolving planets and things, but you're a very small part of the universe. It's all overlapped. It's all a Venn diagram. And given this new world, you know, there's no way to manage every planet and every star and everything that's happening out there individually. The level of scale in an ecosystem is at least 10x what you have today. If IBM has 120,000 partners, they need a million within 5 years. AWS is going to have a million partners. Microsoft's going to have, you know, a couple million partners. I mean, that level of scale where the whole world of the channel account manager and this one-to-one sales management of a channel, the partnerships, the elements, the programs, the technology, everything that goes into that gets disrupted in an ecosystem. Now you're in a world of trying to predict when the stars and moon are going to align and try to align them in your favor. So who are going to be those five people in the room with that customer? How many of those people are endorsing us or could have that ability to endorse us? How do I, you know, enhance the collaboration, the communication? How do I sales enable them? How do I, you know, co-market and co-sell with them? How do I make sure that they have the right onboarding and the training and the incentives and the motivation and the loyalty to me? The 100 things that make up a partnership. How do I make sure all those things happen minutes before those stars and moons align? And I can do that at a level of scale millions of times per day. This is now an AI problem. It's not a human problem. It's not a linear problem. So the way that I deploy people, the way that I deploy processes, the way that I deploy my program, and the way I deploy technology to underpin all that is different. So I published a channel software tech stack a couple of weeks ago, which I do every year. This year, I added that ecosystem bubble. The companies that are looking at this level of self-service, this level of flexibility, this level of scale at a level that we've just never thought about before, and what that's going to look like in a trifurcated model where 80% of your partners don't actually transact, and how attribution and all the rest of the stuff works. So this is a turning point for you, for what you study, for the entire, and this isn't just technology, it's every industry is going through this at the same time.
They all seem to be struggling with this too, that, you know, you talk about the scale of this, right? Showing up with the right technology at the right point with that customer and ensuring, because you can't have Bob, the partner development manager, doing it anymore, right? I mean, if you're scaling across the numbers of partners you're talking about, it can't be a human being any longer.
Yeah. So one of my suggestions to vendors is to take Bob, you know, who's a great guy, he's been great at the Christmas party, everybody loves him, you know, probably didn't make it in direct sales. That's why he's, you know, running, has a channel role. I'm just joking. Bob's a great guy.
Somewhat true.
So stop, you know, thinking about Bob and having him cover a certain geography or a certain type of partner. You know, he may be sitting in Chicago at CDW as a funded head. You know, he may be sitting down in Tampa with Tech Data as a funded head, maybe covering Georgia as a territory. But start thinking about Bob as a community manager instead of a channel manager.
That's interesting. Tell me more about it.
There's 35 million different parts of my heat map. And by the way, there's no company that covers that entire heat map. There just isn't. There's too many permutations. But every company has a different set of hotspots on that heat map. When I study those heat maps, I look at a place of growth. Like, you know, we do really well at mid-sized clinics in upstate New York. I'm going to make Bob the community manager for mid-sized clinics in the Northeast. So I'm going to have Bob understand why we do so well in that market. I'm going to then have Bob look at adjacencies. So can we take our product and add adjacencies to our product to win more business? Can we move next door from New York to Pennsylvania and go win there? Can we move the customer, mid-sized clinics with 50 doctors? Could we take that to a small hospital or to a big dentist office and still win? Can we take, like, move across the vectors and have Bob figure that out? Then go have Bob look at the influence, the sphere of influence. Study these five people that the average mid-sized clinic, you know, has in this virtual room. What do they read? Where do they go? And who do they follow? Are the three very simple questions that Bob can go and answer. And Bob can do this at home during COVID by just surfing the web.
So what they read, where do they go, and who do they follow? Is that what you said?
What do they read? Which, as you know, there's a lot of ways to read today. You can listen to podcasts, you can go to a webinar, you can read an ebook, you can read a newsletter. There's 30 ways to read. But where do they go? And today it's virtually, but you know, the channel is invited to 150 shows last year before COVID, and they will again after COVID. And then number three is, who do they follow? That's the most important question. So if Bob goes and answers that question for that part of the heat map, that mid-sized clinic, as they have a problem bringing new patients in the door, that marketing buyer, what do they read? And you could start following the breadcrumbs. So what podcasts do they listen to? What newsletters? What magazines? What LinkedIn groups? What Facebook groups? What subreddits? What associations are they a member of? What other vendor communities are they a member of? What wholesale distribution communities? What peer groups? What events? You can actually map all that. And I do this on one PowerPoint slide. You just put all the logos on one slide. Once Bob has done that, go and double click on every one of those logos. Start scoring the people underneath it. Who's keynoting those events? Who sits on the board of those associations? Who's on the front cover of the magazine? Who's the host of the podcast? You know, who's the Vince in that space? And start scoring every time those people show up. And now you've built yourself, you're probably 1,000 people show up in a mid-sized clinic sphere of influence. But now that I've scored them, you know, you get 8 points for being in the biggest magazine or on the biggest board of the biggest association. You get 2 points for doing a roadshow through Rochester. So now that I've scored it, I just sort it and find the top 50, top 100 people in that space. Bob's job is to go and meet all 50 or 100 of those people to get their actionable advice on what you should be doing as a vendor or software company or whoever you are to better win and get more than your fair share of that market. So that free consulting. And over time, over the 6 months, I want Bob to win the endorsement of a good set of those people because they have the tribe. They have the following. They're the Vince of that market. So they have people listening to the podcast and plugged into everything you say. So if you were to say something nice about that company going after mid-sized clinics in upstate New York, that's probably worth $1 million. When I did this at Lenovo, several of those endorsements were worth $10 million of ThinkPad sales. And they only cost me $5,000 in sponsorship. So Bob is now my community manager who knows what people read, where they go. He's actually going to those places today virtually, but physically next year. And Bob is becoming one of those top 100 people. Bob knows all the other people. That's Bob's Rolodex. And those people are using their platforms to say something nice about Bob's company. Bob has now driven 80% market share in a very small market and is driving the adjacencies further. That's much more than Bob could have ever done with Tech Data or CDW.
Good point and good advice for our listeners. I know some of this is in your blog posts, and if you don't mind, I'd like to share some of that with our listeners in our show notes.
Yeah, of course.
So I just wanted to spend a little bit of time with you on your personal and professional journey, Jay. I mean, you have an interesting story. You didn't grow up in Florida. I want you to tell us a little bit more about how you got here. And also, how did you get started in technology?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Canada, and I grew up in Edmonton and Calgary watching Wayne Gretzky win Stanley Cups. You know, over time, and I will say, you know, my dad was an accountant, so I grew up, you know, counting things. He had an old ledger that every penny the family spent, you know, went on the ledger and things like that. So when I turned 11, my mom was a computer teacher, and she used to lug home, and this was, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and she would lug home an Apple II with monitor and printer in the trunk of her Honda Accord. And that, you know, these things were like 50, 60 pounds. And my mom, I think, is like 5'2" on her tippy toes. So I got to, you know, after playing games for a few hours, you know, I got to teach myself basic. By the time I was 11, I started tracking everything in my life. First and foremost, I got my first paper route. So every dollar I made, I tracked, and then where I spent it. This was years before Microsoft Money or Quicken. I had my own data trail for every dollar I've ever made. And up until today, I could give you to the second decimal point, every dollar I've ever earned or spent, where I spent it, what I spent it on, and track that. So that was kind of the future. You know, that was my computer. That was this analysis tied in together. A few years later, it was like when I was 15, Top Gun came out. You know, I watched the movie like every other, you know, hot-blooded, red-blooded, you know, 15-year-old did. And I saw the motorcycle. I went back to my computer and analyzed, you know, how much money, because by then I was pumping gas and doing other jobs. You know, could I, you know, get that motorcycle? I phoned, you know, no internet back then. So I phoned the dealership, and they told me that that Ninja 900 EX was $4,000. But by that time, I was already making $8,000 a year. So I knew on my 16th birthday that if I stopped doing everything, drinking and going to movies, and if I just stopped everything for 6 months, I could be riding that motorcycle to high school on my 16th birthday. And with analysis, with computers, I went and made it happen.
Nice.
I actually stopped drinking at that point, and I've never had a drink since. But it was kind of a life story for me that kind of pushed me towards this intersection of technology and data. And every heartbeat of mine, every minute of sleep, every calorie I consume, every dollar I spend, everything is tracked in my personal life. And it's just a personal, you know, fascination with me in terms of making everything scientific in the same way I look at the industry.
So how did you get into the partnership and channel world?
So in college, I was going to college in Southern Alberta in a kind of a farming community. And, you know, my dad, who worked for the government as an accountant, said, don't work for the government. You got to get into private sector. The best way to do that is, you know, internships. And, you know, I looked at my university, I went to the internship, you know, department, and basically there was two companies coming through looking for interns. One was Cargill to work in a meat processing plant, and the other was IBM, who, you know, was looking in their help desk. And so the captain of the hockey team ended up going and working at Cargill, and they made all their management trainees go on the floor for a year. So he lost all his fingernails, like pulling hides off of animals. And it was just a disastrous, you know, internship. And I worked and I went in my first day at IBM in 1994 and started taking help desk calls. I was supposed to be just doing the analytics, like how many calls, how long did people spend in the bathroom. And I was supposed to be making spreadsheets to help management. But I walked in and there was, you know, that day, IBM in 1994 had just sold like millions of Aptivas, millions in Canada, licenses of NHL Hockey 94. And for those people who bought a $3,000 Aptiva and a $50 game, you plop in the CD-ROM and boot it up, and your $3,000 investment didn't work. So I looked on somebody's screen, and there was 45 calls waiting on average for over an hour, and it was blinking red. And I thought to myself, my manager was nowhere to be found. I thought, you know what? I don't think they need spreadsheets. I sat down at an empty desk, asked my neighbor what to do. He leaned over and like slapped something on my phone, and I got my first phone call. 2 weeks later, my manager actually came and introduced herself to me and said, Jay, first of all, I haven't got a spreadsheet from you. I have no idea, you know, how the call center is doing, but I did download the results, and I did find out that in North America, you are our number one performing help desk rep. You took more calls and answered more questions in a faster amount of time than any of our thousands of reps. So I'm not mad, but you didn't log any of those calls and you didn't use our systems, but you helped. And thank you for that. And I got a full-time job, you know, at IBM because of that.
Oh, that's funny.
So that was my kind of entry. And from there, that's why I moved, you know, IBM. I've been moved. I've been married, you know, moved me 8 times. I moved over to Lenovo when that happened. I moved down to Raleigh, North Carolina from Toronto to work, you know, at headquarters. And then from there, I wanted to be a CEO by age of 40. So I went and did a software startup to be able to do that. And 3 years ago, ended up moving over to Forrester to become the grumpy industry curmudgeon.
I wouldn't call you a curmudgeon.
Well, that's what I'm hoping to be. Like over the next decade or two, maybe I can become a curmudgeon.
I do see you more as the eyes and ears of the channel, though, for many of us. So I wouldn't call you curmudgeon-y. So let's talk about your personal life just a little bit. What do you like to do when you're not doing this and counting channel companies and automation companies and the like? What do you do for fun with you and your family?
Yeah, so we do a lot of things. I have a blog, jaymcbain.com, jaymcbain.com, that I talk a lot about these things. But you know, I'm fascinated with a lot of things. You know, I talked about not drinking, which you know created more money. So I've had a lot of cars. I've kind of ripped through kind of every kind of car and had a pretty full garage of fun cars and stuff. Motorcycles as well. I've had, you know, a lot of fun that, a lot of fun boats, but not just to sit at the dock. I mean, our family has gone on thousands upon thousands of miles. We've covered every major city on the Eastern Seaboard, from New York to Boston to Washington to Philadelphia to Baltimore by water. So we do a lot of exploration nautically. We're going to cross the ocean when I partially retire at some point. So a lot of, you know, kind of boat level opportunities. I mentioned I had 4 kids, 2 in college and 2 in preschool. So a lot of family time. But probably the number one thing we do in our personal time is travel. My wife has set up a travel website, Traveling with Kids. It's kind of Travels Through Our Eyes, it's called. And we've covered almost 100 countries with kids. And we've covered 6 of the 7 continents so far. And in January, we go to Antarctica as our 7th and final continent. So given the world that we're in and the, you know, the what I'll call the green, yellow, and red threat vectors around the world, hitting 100 countries is pretty aggressive with young kids.
It is.
And, you know, we got to be very selective and obviously take a lot of stock in terms of where we go, given, you know, those risk factors. But, you know, traveling the world has been kind of our thing. And all 100 of those countries have been on vacation and, you know, really driven towards experiences as a family.
Are you doing anything close to home now with COVID?
We try to spend, being in Florida has been a big bonus. We have a pool, you know, in the backyard. And, you know, we've been out on bicycles and we've, you know, we try to get out socially distanced as much as possible. We do, you know, kind of hit the beach, but not the public beaches, you know, when they're open, that we're, you know, not 6 feet. My wife actually has a heart condition. So there's a double circumstance for us that, you know, we're high risk as a family with her condition. So we're doubling down on masks. We double down on social distancing. And we've been, you know, isolating and self-governing ourselves through this process. And, you know, we have to question the January trip to Antarctica. I know that penguins don't have COVID, but, you know, given South America and given the situation in Brazil right now, you know, we're going to have to make a decision by October, whether it's, you know, to go or not to go.
That's going to be a challenge traveling there from here, I guess.
It is. And whether, I mean, most countries in the world don't allow the U.S. passport in at this moment. Whether, you know, however we weather this second storm of COVID is going to be a big indicator. But we have to look at those countries that we're going to be touching, like Chile, Argentina, Brazil, on the way to Antarctica and make an assessment on risk. And you can only go to Antarctica for about 2 or 3 weeks of the year when it's unfrozen. So if we don't go in January, we have to postpone it till 2022.
So I want to ask you about what advice you would give to your 20 or 25 year old self.
And it's interesting because I have kids of that age. The advice I give to myself, the advice I give to them is hyper-specialize. You know, one of my daughters wants to be a lawyer, but you know, there's research out there to say that, you know, 47% of current jobs, you know, could be replaced by technology that's already shipping. And when you look at the legal industry, it could be upwards of 80%. So go grab one of those vectors, one of those 35 million permutations in the legal industry. And whether it's AI or whether it's blockchain, or just grab 5 of those vectors together and start blogging about it and start following other people who are experts in that area. Remember this, what you read, where you go, and who you follow. You're going to find out when you put all those vectors together, there's a very few amount of people that are really driving the conversation in that area. When you start to listen to them and follow them and learn what they're talking about, over time, you're going to start to inject your own opinions and your own thinking, because you're a millennial and you're going to be thinking differently than a 60-year-old lawyer is thinking about that same problem. And over time, you're going to become your own voice. You're going to find your own voice, not only on your own podcast or your own blog, but you're going to start finding it in the legal community. They're going to ask you to speak at the association. They're going to ask you to engage as people think about this. You're going to have put in the 10,000 hours necessary in that very specific area to be one of the super connectors in the world. That's your ticket in. You don't have to go and, you know, be born in the right space or graduate from the right college or be anointed. It's hard work, but you're going to earn your spot in your profession. And where technology interlaces now every job and every industry and every company's becoming a tech company, you've found your spot. And whatever you end up doing as a job day to day, you're going to now have a hobby. You're going to have something that has exposure for you and really keeps your mind connected to where things go from here.
I love that advice. It reminds me also of Kevin Kelly's 1,000 Raving Fans, right? If you become hyper-specialized and an expert in that one area, you bring those people along and then that multiplies.
Yeah. And one day Vince will have you on his podcast.
That's right. That's right. I can't wait. So Jay, it has been exciting having you. I'm thrilled that you were able to join us. I know how busy and compressed your schedule is these days, especially with all the talks you're giving and all podcasts and all the events you've been participating on. I want to thank you for joining the Ultimate Guide to Partnering. Any closing comments for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot we talked about and there's a lot to unpack, but it starts with the health and safety and really ongoing concern of your business. Second, it's customers and being obsessed over your customers. They're going to lead you out of this. They're going to lead you to the bright spots. And then third, it's, you know, really around driving a legacy, you know, driving a brand that supersedes you. And, you know, 50 years ago, the impact that you have on others and how you behaved and how you participated, how you rolled up your sleeves and all this work that you did through your career and how this will have a lasting impact to those around you and those that, you know, can be inspired by it. That's, I think, the future for all of us. And wherever, whatever stage we are in our careers and in our businesses, you know, those are the things that, you know, we focus on the most.
And if our listeners want to reach out to you, what's the best way to do so?
Anywhere. I am on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook, wherever you feel comfortable there. My blog, jmcbain.com, or the blog on Forrester. Kind of my ears are open everywhere if you want to have a conversation or if you need some of these stats or charts or research to help something in your business. Always happy to help, always happy to lend a hand. And again, you can find me on a Google search or pretty well everywhere.
Great. Thank you so much, Jay. It's been a pleasure having you on Ultimate Guide to Partnering. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Minzione. Online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.